In this next hour, we hear the first of a three-part lecture series on the right-wing takeover of the judiciary. Today's talk is by attorney Bill Marshall. He's a constitutional lawyer teaching at the University of North Carolina. He also worked as deputy White House counsel under President Bill Clinton and served as the Solicitor General of Ohio. He graduated from the University of Chicago Law School. The title of his talk is The Conservative Takeover of the Federal Judiciary and Its Implications Going Forward. The talk took place on June 27, 2019 at the Madison Public Library and was sponsored by the American Constitution Society and the Madison Institute.
Thank you all for coming out today. Nothing like a Supreme Court opinion to trigger some interest in what's going on. As you all heard, the Supreme Court, not surprisingly, said it was going to do nothing about partisan gerrymandering. Yes, it's a problem, they admit, but hey, we're too busy. We can't figure out how to solve it, so we're not going to get involved. In the census case today, there was a, I think, correctly called a reprieve. The court indicated, at least on some of the substantive challenges to including the citizenship question, that that might be permissible, but the court said that what this particular Commerce Department did was to rely on non-persuasive reasons as to why they were adding the citizenship question, and so remanded that issue. We'll see what happens. We'll see if the Commerce Department tries to act quickly to try to get the question back on the census, but at least as of right now, it seems to be off. We'll see how long that lasts. I'm here to talk about the conservative takeover of the federal judiciary, which they have been working at, as I will talk about, for 50 or 60 years now, and actually done so quite successfully, particularly under a new model that they adopted a mere 30 years ago. Anybody know, by the way, was the last time there was a Democratic majority on the United States Supreme Court? Anybody want to guess? 1969 was the last time there was a majority of Democratic appointees. I think that's the right year, but somewhere in that vicinity. That's the last time there were a majority of Democrats on the Supreme Court. The lesson I want to talk about today is that the Supreme Court, it not only sometimes doesn't fix things like it did with partisan gerrymandering today, sometimes it does real harm. The Reconstruction Court, when it decided the Slaughterhouse cases, the Civil Rights cases, and Plessy versus Ferguson, basically gutting the Privileges and Immunities Clause, the Due Process Clause, the Equal Protection Clause, saying that the Congress couldn't address private discrimination, and then upholding separate but equal, put back civil rights in this country 100 years. It took us 100, well, we haven't recovered from it, because the vestiges of Jim Crow still have created this massive inequality that we see in our society. In the late 19th century, in the early 20th century, the Lochner Court stepped in and struck down all kinds of regulations and laws trying to ameliorate some of the harms of the Industrial Revolution. And it took another 50 or 60 years before we got out of that mess. But interestingly, neither of those courts were explicitly picked for those results. Some of the justices, for example, in the Reconstruction Court were picked by Lincoln and Grant, and some of them were actually ardent abolitionists. But the court went in that direction anyway. The justices that went in the Lochner Court, some of them were picked for conservative purposes, but President Wilson picked James McReynolds, who he thought was not going to go in that direction, and McReynolds turned out to be one of the more conservative justices in history. Now what we've had, though, is intentional picking of justices to achieve specific results. And how do I know that? Because Ed Meese told me. Ed Meese wrote a series of memorandums when he was in the Justice Department talking about how we need to pick conservative justices to accomplish specific results. And let me recommend an article by Don Johnson, D-A-W-N Johnson of the University of Indiana, who wrote a wonderful article talking about the Meese memorandum and the impact that's had. And The fact is that the effects of this conservative court are considerable. We've sort of been glossed over on how conservative this court really is by the gay rights decisions. Because of all of the decisions of the last 10, 15 years, those have probably gotten the most public attention. And those decisions were wonderful decisions, I think. But they glossed over the fact that while the court might have been deciding those cases and a few cases here and there on criminal procedure, it was enacting an incredibly conservative agenda. Let me give you a few examples. Race. Shelby County, one of the worst cases in United States history because of its effect, struck down the preclearance requirements coming mainly from the South, dealing with the changes in voting rules, which led to a new era of legislators, and not just in the South, as this state well knows, intended for voter suppression without justice preclearance. At the same time, the court has upheld affirmative action, but only by a whisker, and making it incredibly difficult for any program to survive what's left of affirmative action, and they're just waiting to finish it off entirely now that Justice Kennedy's no longer there. They even struck down provisions of the Seattle and the Louisville School that weren't affirmative action at all. They were integration measures trying to balance the schools to the overall demography of the various cities, and the court said it couldn't even do that. How about religion? Okay, this past week the court upheld a 40-foot cross in Bladensburg, Maryland. That decision probably, I was talking to Jeff about this earlier, although it was written by Alito, is actually very Breyer-esque. Breyer's concerned about the effect of taking away religious monuments and the division that that might cause, and you could see those themes. But outside of that on religion, let me give you a few examples. In Zelman versus Harris, the court upheld school vouchers. In another case called Mitchell versus Helms, the court said the state could even give computers and other kind of equipment to explicitly, pervasively sectarian institutions without violating the Establishment Clause. Okay, fair enough, maybe. But most recently, a couple years ago, in a case called Trinity Lutheran, the court then said, and if you don't provide benefits that you're providing to non-religious things, that also could raise a constitutional problem. Trinity Lutheran was kind of minor in the benefit it allowed, but at least Justice Thomas's and Gorsuch have indicated that they're going to go real far, so saying that if a state even tries not to violate Establishment Clause norms, that could run afoul of the Free Exercise Clause. Property rights. The Supreme Court a couple days ago in a case that hasn't got that much attention yet, but pay attention particularly for those of you who work in local government, in a case called Nick versus Township of Scott, said that that takings take place the minute the government acts and not when the government doesn't compensate, which is how you would normally think of a takings. The takings allows the government to take property as long as they compensate. What the rules had been for over 100 years was that the taking doesn't take place unless you show the state's not going to compensate. Now the court held, no, the taking takes place right away. The effect, the inhibition that that's going to cause on local government is going to be significant, particularly when they engage in environmental kinds of regulations or other kinds of regulations of that type. In civil procedure of all areas, the court has moved back on the scope of personal jurisdiction and has made pleading a lot difficult, thereby limiting access to the courts. In all of these kinds of areas, the court is cutting back. Now, I didn't mention First Amendment, because First Amendment speech, they've been real vibrant. Citizens United is one, and a number of other cases in which the court is basically bringing back Lochner to strike down governmental regulations under the guise of free speech. So they're using that as a sword, not as a protection of what we would normally consider to be actual free speech kinds of issues. Well, why did this happen? How did this happen? I got one word answer for you. Marketing. And I'm not kidding.
You're listening to attorney Bill Marshall speaking on the conservative takeover of the federal judiciary and its implications going forward.
And that's why we're here today, and that's why I'm here today. Marketing. The mantra from the conservatives has been for 50 years and really in the last, and really since the 80s particularly, conservatives apply real law. They're the strict constructionists. They're the originalists. And all liberals are concerned with is just results. Well, I got no problem with just results, by the way. But the fact is, this is not true. And by the way, who buys into this? Liberals. We often talk about it this way. We often talk about what we're doing is seeking justice and not necessarily applying hard rules of law. But the fact is, and what I want to talk about, is actually liberal progressive jurisprudence does apply real law. And originalism is a fallacy. Let me provide a little bit of history. What may be called liberal constitutional interpretation is actually more originalist than originalism. Originalism itself goes back only 40 years or so. There are a few cases from the 19th century, 18th century, but originalism itself is a new theory. And it's not the neutral theory of interpretation that it purports to be, but it's little more than a result-oriented theory under a historical guise, but they've got the public believing it. And that has given the political power to the conservative right. Now, how did conservative jurisprudence arise in the first place? Well, much of it was a reaction to the Warren Court, school prayer, Miranda, the exclusionary rule, later Roe versus Wade, which is actually decided under the Burger Court. And the reaction to that by President Nixon and others is what we need is judicial restraint. What a great thing. We shouldn't have courts striking down the decisions of popularly elected officials, whether they be executive or legislative. And then something interesting happened. The conservatives took over the courts, and then all of a sudden, hey, maybe striking down laws isn't such a bad thing. This way, and they started changing their theory. So the theory changed from an idea of judicial restraint to it's perfectly okay for us to strike down laws, and we're going to do so under this originalist theory. Now, the originalist theory is really interesting. It started off as original intent. What would Madison think about a particular issue? Well, that didn't work particularly well because I've done a lot of reading of James Madison, but I've never read anything that he's had to say about speech on the internet. Nor have I ever read what he's had to say about electronic searches. So there are a lot of things that didn't work, and it was made fun of, and so the conservatives decided to move to something else. They moved to something called original meaning. We aren't going to try to get into the heads of the framers. We're just going to take what the original meaning of these words were, and that's what the real law is. Well, that didn't work out so much. So then they moved to abstractions of those terms so they could accommodate at least some technological change. So much so that a friend of mine wrote an article called Living Originalism, because the theory itself keeps changing in order to adjust to the particular cases they wanted to. Now, what were the purposes of what they were trying to do? Well, they said, we want to make the Constitution law and not just the decision of judges. We want to cabin results. But the real reason, and this is what the Mies memos were all about, is they wanted to lead to specific results. So how have they actually applied originalism? Well, they've got this theory. They say it's what the law is, and they apply it in every single case except when they don't. And they don't do it a lot. Let's take one example that is at the center of the conservative legal agenda, abolishing affirmative action. You cannot get there at the federal level by relying on originalism. Why? Well, first of all, the Congress after the Civil War provided all kinds of special benefits to African Americans. But second, the Equal Protection Clause doesn't apply to the federal government. It applies only to the states. Yes, there was a case called Bowling versus Sharp, which was a companion case to Brown versus Board of Education, which said the District of Columbia couldn't segregate schools either. It's a wonderful decision. But Bowling versus Sharp wasn't originalist. So when we get to abolishing affirmative action, all of a sudden, oh, well, we're going to live by Bowling versus Sharp, says the conservative court, even though it's completely removed from any understanding of originalism. Citizens United. The framers hated corporations. They distrusted corporations. The idea that the framers would have endorsed, or if you want to use public meaning, that the public would have endorsed at that time, corporations influencing elections is outrageous. Takings. Remember takings a little while ago, and I talked about this new case? Let's go back to some of the original cases where Justice Scalia was trying to put new vibrancy into the takings clause to limit environmental and other kinds of regulations. What did Justice Scalia rely on in that key decision? Something he called constitutional culture. Said, can't find it in the text. We're going to look at constitutional culture. Say what? Others. In the 11th Amendment cases dealing with sovereign immunity, they rely on history and ignore text. In the state affirmative action cases, they rely on text and not history. It's a moving target with one particular result in mind, the achievement of conservative results. And sometimes they just make it up out of whole cloth. A bunch of decisions made up this decision, something called anti-commandeering, about how the federal government cannot commandeer the states. I won't get into that. I won't bore you with what that, with the specifics is. They made it up. In Shelby County, the idea of equal sovereignty. They made that one up as they went along. And then when they aren't making things up, they're leading to inconsistent results. So in Trump versus Hawaii, the court says, you know, the fact that candidate Trump and President Trump said all these nasty things, that really doesn't really tell us about the merits of the underlying substantive claim. So we aren't going to strike it down because of improper purpose. But in the masterpiece keg shop case, dealing with whether or not somebody had a free exercise and a free speech right not to provide a cake to a gay couple, the court said that one commissioner sitting on the Colorado Civil Rights Commission said something bad, and that's a good indication of bad purpose. Hello, this is violative of the free exercise clause. So they're not even consistent. Another case called Becerra, the court strikes down under First Amendment grounds requirements of California that these clinics would sort of advise people to not have abortions, don't have to have any kind of, provide any kind of notice, provide any kind of disclosure, while same time saying that doctors who do provide abortion have to provide disclosure. There's not even an effort for consistency. Progressive constitutional interpretation has a better answer. And it goes way back. It goes back to 1819 to Chief Justice John Marshall. And these are the exact words of Chief Justice John Marshall. We must never forget it is a constitution we are expounding, intended to endure for ages to come and consequently to be adapted to the various crises of human affairs. It's a constitution. It's something that in order for it to be able to endure, it has to adapt. And he said that in 1819, and I think John Marshall probably had a better inclination of what the framers were trying to do than Ed Meese. I could be wrong, but what this recognizes is that the Constitution sets forth broad principles that we have to look at, and text and history give us some insight into that. But the central challenge of constitutional interpretation is to define and give life and substance to those principles in an ever-changing society. Is this perfect? No. Can you make mistakes? Yes, but this is lawyering. It's common law lawyering. And this means that it wasn't a problem when the United States Congress decided to create an Air Force, although there is nothing in the Constitution that allows the Air Force, Navy and Army, you're in. Air Force, not mentioned. Unconstitutional. By the way, when you're talking to folks, saying that they're originalists, ask them if they think the Air Force is unconstitutional. It kind of works. The evidence of this being what the framers wanted to do when they set up a constitution comes from a couple of things. First of all, they were common law lawyers. They understood that law changes to apply to current circumstances, and they used deliberately vague words. Equal protection of the laws, other things like that, commerce. All of these terms did not have scientific meaning to them. And by the way, some of them were a result of political compromise. Some of them were because the framers wanted to be interpreted later on. And some of them were political compromise.
You're listening to attorney Bill Marshall speaking on the conservative takeover of the federal judiciary and its implications going forward.
James Madison and Patrick Henry had about as much in common as Nancy Pelosi and Kevin McCarthy. It wasn't like everybody got together in Philadelphia, sang Kumbaya, and had a clear meaning of what all of these provisions meant. They used these deliberately ambiguous terms, understanding that they would be interpreted as history evolved and circumstances changed. The framers were visionaries. They weren't interested in just solving the problems of the day. And when I talk to people about originalism, I said, really? You guys, and this is a technical word, you're dissing the framers. Right? You're suggesting they were only concerned with the problems of the day. I want to give you an exercise, I heard somebody say, yeah, when I mentioned the University of Chicago. I don't know who it was. But my old professor at the University of Chicago, he'll kill me if I use the word old, but Jeff Stone. Gave an example. I'm not sure which one he used, but let's assume all of us in this room agree that we want to pass a constitutional amendment addressing data privacy. Okay? We want to find protections of data privacy of some kind. So we all get together, we all agree on some language. How many of us would really want our understanding today of what data privacy means to govern how that constitutional provision would be applied 100 years from now when we have no idea what the technology is? My guess is none of us. My guess is even if Ed Meese was in the room, he wouldn't want that. But that's what originalism tries to claim the framers were up to. We have the answer. Now, are there problems with it? Yes. As again, there are problems with what you might call John Marshall's system of constitutional interpretation, one of which is it's hard to summarize in a bumper sticker. And that gets me back to the marketplace of ideas. You know, the thing is, I mean, any of you guys, intellectual property lawyers, talk to me afterwards, because the Federalists took this term originalism and they used it for them. Our side is really the originalist side. Our side is really the way the constitutional interpretation was, but they got a great word. And we have to keep on pushing back on that, and that's difficult. Let me show you one more example about how this really plays out. One of my favorite examples that doesn't have the sort of hot button resonance now that it did, certainly at the time the case was decided. There are many, many important decisions, by the way, that are non-originalist. Brown versus Board of Education is a key one. The drafters of the 14th Amendment supported segregated schools. You can't get one person, one vote out of Reynolds versus Sims out of a reading of the Constitution. Can't be done on an originalist grounds. But let me give you one other one, one of my favorite cases because I teach First Amendment. Case is called West Virginia versus Barnett. Y'all familiar with that one? It's a case dealing with the rights of the Jehovah's Witnesses not to have to salute the flag and say the Pledge of Allegiance. The case was decided in the middle of World War II. Where the United States Supreme Court said, we are not going to require people under the First Amendment to salute the flag and say the Pledge of Allegiance. In the middle of World War II, Imagine the patriotism issues there. Imagine how that would play today on that particular ground. And 2 years earlier, actually, the court, in an earlier decision, said it didn't violate the Free Exercise Clause to force the Jehovah's Witnesses to salute the flag and say the Pledge of Allegiance. Now, you can't make an originalist argument that saying the Pledge of Allegiance is unconstitutional. Why? There's only one prohibition in the Constitution prohibiting forced oaths. It's something called the Religious Test Oath Clause, and it says you can't require people to take an oath in order to assume a public office. And then when if you want to go forward to the Civil War, there are all kinds of oaths imposed upon Confederates coming back into the Union. The text of the First Amendment says it talks about freedom of speech. It doesn't talk about the freedom not to speak. Well, what was it that led the United States Supreme Court in 1943 to strike down required Pledge of Allegiance and saluting the flag? The answer is the court looked across the pond. And when it looked across the pond, it saw that the hallmark of a totalitarian society was forcing people to make pledges of allegiance and salute the flag. Now, that wasn't apparent in the same way prior to 1943 as it was in the middle of World War II. You get meaning out of context. And that's what the Constitution was giving us, and that's what the framers gave us. Now, as I said at the beginning, we haven't been doing very well on this. Three things. I'm going to give three proposals here. First of all, we have to care. We have to care about the courts. It's easy today. We're all motivated because of what a miserable morning we've had. But, sorry, liberals get distracted by new shiny objects. All the time, we get distracted by new shiny objects. The thing about the Federalist Society, give them credit, they've stayed on this consistently. Some of us in here have gone to Federalist Society programs and spoken. You always hear the mantra. They don't give it up. We get distracted. We have to care. The court's one of the top three reasons that people voted for Donald Trump. It didn't make the top 10 of the people who voted for Hillary Clinton. Think about that today. Right at the top of what motivates the Republican base, nowhere in the frame of reference. But if the election was tomorrow, yeah, Democrats would be out there voting on this issue. By the time 2020 comes around, we'll see. We just don't stay with it. So number one, we have to care. Number two, we have to market. We have to explain to people that, yes, originally, I teach first-year con law. Students come in a first-year con law, and they want the rules. They want to know what it is. They don't want to hear that things can be debated the way common law decisions can be debated. The Federalist Society and this conservative thing, originalism, promises them actual results. There's an attraction there, because they think that's real law. We have to point out that isn't real law. It's not real law for two reasons. It's not real law because that's not what the conservatives are actually doing. They're pulling the wool over your eyes, and we can talk about some of the examples we've already talked about today in doing that. And it's not real law because that's not what a constitution is. A constitution is something that Marshall explained does have to be adapted. So two, we got to market it. We got to explain it. How do you do it? Yeah, we've been searching for the missing bumper sticker word since ACS was established in around 2000. Still haven't come up with it yet. There's a prize for anybody who does it. And the final thing is, we have to take the long view. The Federalist Society and the conservatives and the originalists didn't win this battle overnight. It took them a long time to get to where they are right now. But this is a fight that we have to make every day until we finally turn things around, because the effect, there's three cases that before on my way over here, I took a look at the agenda for next term. There are three cases. One that We know how they're going to come out. One is whether sexual orientation is sex under the Civil Rights Act on discrimination. There's a gun case out there. The gun case is not the best facts in the world, by the way. And the third one deals with what you have to prove to show racial discrimination. You know, they have a majority there. We know how it's going to go. We can't forget that it's going to take a long time to turn this all around, but it's worth it. And so there's my talk to you. I'll take questions. Don't ask me too much of the intricacies of this morning's opinions because I haven't had that much time to take. I will tell you one story. And one of my jobs when I worked in the Clinton White House was when Supreme Court Week took place. I had to fashion the White House response to any particular decision, and they didn't let me do that by myself. In order to do that, you had to get the reactions of all the interesting parts of the federal bureaucracy, which are considerable. You got to get sign off from the Justice Department. You got to get sign off for everything. Rahm Emanuel was in charge of this process. And Rahm couldn't understand why we had to read the opinions before we could have a reaction to them. I tried to explain it was helpful in order to be able to. He said, well, if CNN can have a reaction to it, why can't the White House Counsel's Office? But anyway, I do not have a reaction to in detail to the census and the redistricting cases from this morning. And another one that comes from Wisconsin, by the way, the question of whether a search and seizure by taking blood from an unconscious person accused of drunk driving, in which the court said you could. Okay, questions. The question is, why can't the left market as good as the right? They are quite good at it. I mean, the classic example is the death tax instead of the estate tax, right? I mean, there have been studies done on how that changed people's opinion of that particular one. In this particular area, they took originalism, which actually probably is the most descriptive thing imaginable, and they did it. They stick with it. We also, I mean, it was Richard Viguerie, who is a conservative theorist, said the problem, the left is a coalition and the right is a movement. So it's a lot harder to come up with cohesive sort of ways to do it when you're coming from a lot of different directions the way that we are. But I'm just going to give them credit. They've been very good at it, and we haven't. And again, when the gay rights decision are decided, we're all celebrating for good reason. Those are great decisions. But we aren't really defending the law part of it. We're defending the result part of it. And we need to start defending the law part of it as well. Yep. Okay, well, the introduction to the question was the circuit courts have immense amount of power. Many cases don't get to the United States Supreme Court. So we're seeing an influx of very conservative judges going on to the circuit courts. And the answer to that is yes. And the question is, what effect has dissolving the filibuster done on that? And remember, it was the Democrats who dissolved the filibuster because the Republicans were stopping judges. We're in a system of payback and payback and payback and endless escalation. The answer to your question is it's had a serious effect. And it's made a lot easier for people to get through. The Republicans are doing other things. They're eliminating the blue slip requirement, which was the requirement that home state senators sign off on particular appointees. They are streamlining the process to get people through. And of course, that's having an effect. And they're also relying heavily on a pipeline coming from the Federalist Society of particular names of people in their network to become judges. I will tell you, ACS, I don't think will ever, because I don't think it's right to have judicial selection delegated to a private entity, but ACS is working on developing networks itself so that when the Democrats take over the presidency or dealing with governors, when governors come on to particular states, or even when the Attorney General is hiring various lawyers, there's a network of people who are interested. So I urge any of you who know people who are good, who are interested in pursuing public service at a high level, contact Jill Dash at the ACS headquarters and give her the names of some of the people that you think should do it. But they've done a great job on that. Tim. Just for the listeners out there, that was a comment much more than a question from Tim Burns, that we should really go back and rely on John Marshall's way of expressing things rather than just simply attacking originalism. My own thought is that we should do both, probably. Yep. The question is, should more of an effort be made to challenge McConnell? I don't think, it's easy to say this in retrospect, but I don't think Democrats did a good job around Merrick Garland. He didn't excite the Democrats because he seemed to be too moderate and not what people were looking for, and because he didn't excite folks, you didn't see the kind of enthusiasm you might have seen if we had picked somebody else. There was a strategy that President Obama used, which is here you've got a centrist, you've got a real judicial crafts person, and not an ideologue, so he should have been, had people like Orrin Hatch who said that they thought the world of Merrick Garland, so that was the way that they went to, but we didn't get the kind of enthusiasm that we might have got otherwise, and again, we get distracted by shiny objects. If something is not exciting, we're not there. Well, by the way, constitutional interpretation is not the most exciting subject in the world to most folks, but we better push it. The question is whether or not Congress's failure to even give a hearing raises a constitutional issue. If it did, it's not a justiciable one. It's not one that the courts could resolve. The question is, should we court pack as a response? I teach at the University of North Carolina. This is relevant to my answer, okay? Way before you guys in Wisconsin thought about the idea of taking away powers from the governor and the attorney general's office, our folks in North Carolina were out front. And one of the areas where they were out front was packing the court of North Carolina, because North Carolina actually has a Democratic majority. You're playing with fire. The example we talked about before of the Democrats blew up the filibuster and look what they got. Court packing has all kinds of problems, not the least of which there would be counter court packing afterwards. And I think it also is damaging or potentially damaging to the idea of the rule of law. Again, I'm not going to give you an affirmative answer on that too. I don't think that Hillary Clinton would have lost if Scalia was still alive. Why? Because when Scalia died, it became perfectly clear what that election would mean. There was a slot right there. You knew what would happen. If you had term limits in every election, you would know exactly what it would mean in terms of the court. And our side doesn't motivate around it. So I think that's not a good result, because it would further politicize the court and have a real concrete way. I mean, say it was Justice Kennedy whose term was limited. Everybody would know on every issue what it would mean to replace Justice Kennedy. And I think that would politicize the courts even more. The question is the undermine, if I understand this, it looks like there's a fair amount of undermining of the rule of law taking place, which is often a precursor to dictatorship and the breakdown of authoritarianism. The increase of authoritarianism. Do I think there's a relationship there? Yeah, I'm not sure it's intentional. I mean, I'm not going to accuse Mitch McConnell of wanting to have a tyranny. But I do think that this constant breaking down of norms is part of the reason that we're leading to this. And also, the increase in presidential power. And by the way, it's not just the Republicans. When I teach constitutional law, people sometimes are activists, they're conservative depending on the issue. You can tell the exact day where people change their views on presidential power, and it's always a January 20th. And the Democrats were really happy when President Obama expanded presidential power. And if you're going to be really happy when that happens, you lose your rule of law argument against when the next president does that. The question is, if we can't court pack, what do we do? And that's a great question. And unfortunately, I think you have to do the long rule to be able to take the courts back. You know, if I was a pro-lifer, the question would have been, after Roe, what am I going to do? The answer is you wait until the courts change, which is why it's so important that we understand what's going on here and why it's important that we give this issue resonance. Because as the Reconstruction courts did and the Lochner court did and as this court is already doing, Shelby County had a massive impact on the elections. And if you don't buy that one, how about Bush versus Gore? Well, let me thank you all for coming out. I really appreciate it.
You've been listening to Attorney Bill Marshall speaking on the conservative takeover of the federal judiciary and its implications going forward. He's a constitutional lawyer teaching at the University of North Carolina. He also worked as Deputy White House Counsel under President Bill Clinton and served as the Solicitor General of Ohio. The talk took place on June 27, 2019, at the Madison Public Library and was sponsored by the American Constitution Society and the Madison Institute. This is the first of a three-part lecture series on the right-wing takeover of the judiciary. The next talk will be July 17th, at the Madison Public Library, and the speaker will be Lisa Graves. She's the co-director of Documented Investigations. The title of her talk is How the Right Uses Dark Money and Shadow Organizations to Capture U.S. and State Supreme Courts. That's Wednesday, July 17th at noon at the Madison Public Library. And the third one will be held Thursday, August 1st at noon at Foley and Lardner Law Offices at 150 East Gilman. That talk will be by the Honorable Charles Shudson. The title of that talk is Independence Corrupted, Decision-Making by Elected Judges. All these talks and more information about each one can be found at the American Constitution Society's website for the Madison chapter is acslaw.org. That's acslaw.org.